This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Lovely to have you here. I'm Jennifer Byrne. What I was scuttling around looking for just then was my chair notes so I could be responsible and brief you to be a responsible audience. But the main thing is actually to wish you a great welcome, just to remind you, please, to turn off your mobiles if you would. I will do the same thing. And I think you've been told at each session that unauthorised recordings of any kind are not permitted during this session. But, of course, we will open the floor to questions. In about 30, 35 minutes. So, lovely to have you here. It's particularly interesting for me. I very much wanted to do this session. I only arrived at the festival last night. Are you all having a great time? Yeah? Yeah. It sounds like a great program. And it's kind of one of those, as part of a very brief introduction to the subject, I'm just back from the Ubud Writers Festival, which is why I couldn't come any earlier. And when I was there, I was chairing a session called Inspiring Women on the subject of them. but it was really, of course, what it became. It was a discussion on the status and position of women in different parts of the world. So what happened was we had Annie Summers there, who I think many of you will know is an Australian feminist. We also had, there was an Iranian feminist who had lived through what was meant to be the great political revolution when the Shah was turfed up. But of course what happened almost immediately after was that women were ordered home and put under a full Shador, among other things. We had an Egyptian woman, one of those who joined the revolution in Tahrir Square, with the excitement that reigned at that time, only to be told, as soon as it was over, go back to your home. She's been briefly disqualified from her position as a professor because, according to her students, she was said something contemptuous of religion, which, of course, she denies absolutely. So, and the third was an Indonesian woman, who was talking about during the Aceh crisis after the tsunami. I'm sure we all remember that. The incredible fights that went on if women ran from their home without head covering. And she told a personal story of 7 days one woman stood and fought for the right to get her daughter back who'd been removed from her because she wouldn't wear her head covering. And so I put that in the context of it's a difficult story, feminism. It's internationally, it's not really in good state, and I think even in Australia we have question marks over different aspects of it, which is one of the reasons it is so fantastic to have Amy Parish here today, because she has a different story. It's a story which is not about opinion or ideology, it's a story of science. She has spent 20 plus years studying bonobos, which are the lesser known in a way, brother, sister, cousin, but relative, the other member of the genus, which includes chimpanzees. We hear a lot about chimpanzees. We haven't heard so much about bonobos. Professor Amy Parish is a biological anthropologist, a primatologist, and a Darwinian feminist. And it is, I'm sure, on that she will be explaining what that means and what the implications are and how it actually does suggest that sometimes you do always get what you want if you're a bonobo. Thank you. Won't you welcome her?
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and thank you to all of you for being here on this gorgeous day. I have to apologize in advance that I seem to be having a lot of allergies, so I hope I don't get completely sneezy and that I don't lose my voice, but so far it's good, but I just wanted to say in advance it's not that I'm ill, but I am affected by the springtime pollen here. So what does it mean to be a Darwinian feminist? Often when I'm introduced to give a talk about bonobos, when it comes to that term, the whole audience laughs, and I always wondered what seems funny about that. But I think even to somebody outside of science, it seems maybe a little counterintuitive that science and feminism would go together. So I want to talk a little bit about that today. I did my undergraduate research at University of Michigan at a time when they were beginning to explore how evolutionary theory could be applied to humans. And I studied with this woman, Barbara Smuts, here on the right of your screen, who was working on baboons. And she'd written a book called Sex and Friendship in Baboons, where she looked at pairs like this male and female here, Alex and Daphne, who are very pair-bonded to each other. And she was really interested in how those pair bonds are formed and what that means and what they're good for. So I had come from a very feminist and activist-based childhood, which I'm very grateful to my mother for having provided. And I did a Bachelor of General Studies degree because I didn't want to be boxed into just a Bachelor of Science or a Bachelor of Arts. And this allowed me to basically make my own program, which I highly recommend. I think university should be all about exploration and inspiration and learning new things. So I was really, really grateful to have that opportunity to have that breadth. I went on from there to grad school with a woman named Sarah Hurdy at University of California, Davis. And oops, sorry, I'm managing two devices at once. Here's Sarah down. Oh no. Sorry, this is my technical. Here's Sarah here. She's kind of considered the alpha female of primatology, you could say. So it was a real privilege to get to work with her. I started writing to her from University of Michigan and saying, I'm really interested in bonobos. I hear that males and females might have unusually friendly relationships with each other, and I'd like to explore that given my undergrad background and thinking about baboons. And she said that despite the fact that she is the alpha female of primatology and very famous for her studies of these Hanuman Langurs in India, that she no longer considered herself a primatologist. She now considered herself to be a natural historian, and she was working on this book, Mother Nature, which took 11 years to write and originally had 400 pages of endnotes. So you can really be certain when you read this book that it's been very well vetted. And we wrote back and forth, and eventually she said, okay, bonobos are close enough, come and work with me. And so that's what I did. I went to UC Davis, and I started writing grants to do some research on bonobos, and I wanted to study their social and sexual behavior. And, you know, because of that interest in pair bonding, that's where I started. But for those of you who came on Friday to my talk, you know that I quickly realized that the most fascinating thing about bonobos was that females have these incredibly close bonds with each other that they then use to dominate males. And this is pretty rare in mammals. And so I got really excited. And I'm grateful that I had the upbringing that I did and the women mentors that I did, because it allowed me to have a really broad perspective that allowed me to actually see that it might be possible for females to have agency and power. One of my other advisors, who I also love very dearly, Franz Duval, you know, was very interested in the direction that I was going in. And I told him that I was noticing a pattern of adult females inflicting serious blood-drawing injuries on adult males as part of this pattern of dominance over them. And he said, oh, you know, that's really interesting. When I studied the same population of bonobos a decade or two earlier, I kept a list of blood-drawing injuries, and I never did anything with it. I'll send it to you. And, you know, this is like a handwritten list. So he sent it to me. There were 25 cases. 24 of them were adult females injuring adult males, and he never noticed it was a pattern, right? And that's because who would think? It's right. It's unnatural, right? Females don't injure males. Females don't have that kind of aggression. Females don't have that kind of motivation. And so it very quickly became a kind of combination study for me from the biological side and the feminist side to study these closest living relatives of ours. And I did it through an anthropology program because I really was interested in what bonobos could tell us about ourselves. So I came from this background as an evolutionary biologist of believing that we can understand our mammalian, our primate, and our human origins and understand our adaptations and behaviors by looking to other apes and looking at how their behavior correlates with their environmental and ecological circumstance. So to go back to Darwin for a minute, you know, he did recognize that, you know, of course he used the term man, but I'm sure he really meant humans. We've now seen that humans are variable in body and mind, and that these variations are induced either directly or indirectly by the same general causes and obey the same general laws as with the so-called lower animals. We now recognize we're not higher, we're not better, we're not the pinnacle of anything, we're just one type of animal. But at least he recognized that we are in that animal kingdom and that we are subject to the same forces. And that's still really controversial today. I mean, in the 80s, when E.O. Wilson started talking, well, actually, even in the early 70s, when E.O. Wilson started talking about sociobiology, the idea that evolution could affect not just whether you're tall or short or blonde or brunette, but also, how you behaved. That was a really controversial thing because a lot of people, particularly on the left, really wanted to believe that everything about human behavior is free will. And that nothing is in any way, not determined, but mediated, let's say, by your biology. And so in gender studies departments, I've often encountered faculty who don't believe we should have a class called something like sex similarities and differences, because they would say there are no differences except those that are culturally produced. And that to me seems like a pretty extreme statement, to say there are no differences between men and women except those that culture produces. I mean, those kinds of polemical statements I don't think are very helpful on either side. So Darwin was really actually fascinated by sex differences between males and females. You know, Linnaeus got it wrong when he was classifying mallards. He classified the male and female mallard as different species because they looked so different. So he really wanted to explain, why are there differences in size sometimes between males and females? Because we're a mammal, we tend to think that when there is a difference in size, that it's more natural or typical for males to be bigger. If you look across the animal kingdom, it's actually much more common for females to be bigger than males. So when you see a spider web with a little spider and a big spider in it, the big spider is usually the female. Of course, there are all kinds of differences in shape, not always, as this jellyfish cartoon shows, but often there are differences in shape. Coloration, these kinds of differences are, I've actually been displayed at by a peacock, and I thought, actually, you're going in the wrong direction. These kinds of differences are not as controversial as when you get to behavior, right? And I like this cartoon from Gary Larson where the female octopus has been waiting back at home and the male comes back to the cave all covered in suction marks. And, because it embodies so many stereotypes that we have about male and female behavior. So females are the homebodies. They're attached to one particular male. They don't want him to mate with anybody else. He's interested in sexual variety and he's out there pursuing that. And there's this kind of conflict between them because of that. And these are really interesting things to explore from an evolutionary perspective. Well, Darwin focused on two specific areas in his thoughts about these sex differences. He looked at male ornaments, really pretty colors, flashy patterns, long tail feathers, those kinds of things. And he said, those evolve because females like them. So he did recognize, in some sense, female agency, and at least females had a part in the process. But, it was sort of this, who knows why they like yellow? Who knows why they like triangles or, neck bands? It was just kind of a female aesthetic whim, right? But at least he recognized the females did make some choices. Male weapons, on the other hand, he thought evolved because males compete over access to females. So males would fight with each other with their horns or their canines or their body armor in order to try to acquire females. And so those were the two components of sexual selection theory that stood all the way from the mid-1800s until the 1990s. Nobody bothered to kind of revisit that or expand it or ask if there was anything more to the picture. Even though Darwin recognized these two components, he was really focused on the male part of that equation. So, it was really about the struggle between males to possess females, but everything was on the line for males in terms of this kind of possession. And so when we look at Darwin's work, although he is responsible for having acknowledged female choice, we also have to say he was incredibly focused on the male-male competition aspect of this pattern. He didn't say much about the dynamics between the sexes, but what he did say is really, really important and sobering. He said that, of course, thought it was just in the so-called savage state, but really it was the human condition. So let's just fill that in for him. In the human condition, man keeps woman in a far more abject state of bondage than does the male of any other animal. And that is really saying something when you know about other animals. So, I mean, there are species of fly that have special appendages so that they can pierce through the wings of a female that they've pinned to the ground to keep her from escaping while he forces her into copulation. That also disables her so that she's not able to fly afterwards and mate with any other males. Male mallards often drown females in the process of forcing them into copulations. Female bee-eater birds can't leave their nest chambers without being escorted by their pair-bonded male, because otherwise sometimes they're forced to the ground by as many as 9 other males trying to force them into copulation. So to say that human females have it the worst is really, really a stark thing, I think, to consider. So when you think about humans, a biologist might look at this picture of this beautiful day when this man and woman joined together, sometimes, you know, each taking their individual candle and not only lighting one, but then extinguishing their own individual candles, not just in a symbolic way, but really, if you look at it, if you step back from it from a biological way, you would say, okay, this is an institutionalized state-sanctioned practice that basically formalizes a trade. Women offer to be sexually monogamous and therefore to give males prescriptive paternity certainty. And in exchange, women get access to resources that the patriarchy has structured so that males broker them. So even though we're very closely related to primates, and that makes it a good reason to look at primate social systems, in terms of ecology, we're very similar to birds. We give birth to helpless young that need a lot of care and attention in order to be reared successfully. It might be possible to do it on your own, but it's a lot easier and a lot better if you have someone to help you. That could either be a male or your kin, but the way that everything's set up, it's most often a male. And so women are stuck in this situation where often they have to go through males to get the resources they need. Birds have a similar problem. They give birth to broods of chicks that are very helpless. If the male does not participate in helping to rear those chicks, then often you lose the whole brood. So female birds and female humans face some of the same kinds of constraints, and therefore it's relevant to look at what kinds of ecological variables relate to the kinds of behavioral patterns that we see. Well, Darwin was a Victorian. He was a product of his times. He wasn't the first, and he's not the last, to believe that females aren't very sexual. So he would write things like, you know, the female is, with the rarest exception, less eager to mate than is the male. She's coy, and she may often be seen endeavoring for a long time to escape. And I love this drawing, which comes from Meredith Small's book, Female Choices. She's a primatologist who works on a species of macaque, where she sees females mating with 8 males in a row and wonders how this can possibly fit in with Darwin's ideas about this kind of coy, choosy, reluctant female. At one point, Darwin had said that often a female isn't picking the male she likes the best. She's picking the male that's least distasteful, right? It kind of reminds me of this, at least what we hear in America, which might be totally incorrect, this idea that in England women were encouraged, you know, during sex to just lay back and think of England, right? That's your patriarchal, your national duty, rather, to just participate in this really unseemly activity for the good of the nation. And, you know, if you look around the animal kingdom, you don't find much evidence to support that females are coy and passive and especially not non-sexual. And yet, everybody seemed to accept that at face value for this basically 150-year period. This man, David Buss, was an evolutionary psychologist at University of Michigan when I was an undergrad, and he's now at University of Texas. He's what's known as an evolutionary psychologist. This is a group of academics who's really interested in sexual selection theory, but they believe that there are human universals. We've evolved that so that all men want as much sex as they can get with young, fertile women. All women want the richest, most high-status men. And they really ignore environmental or ecological variation. So they just think these things are hardwired. And therefore, there's kind of an essential essence to being a male or to being a female. One of his studies that I have particular problems with was a study that he did where he had a very attractive man stand in the middle of campus and basically solicit women as they were walking by to go to class. And he might say anything from, would you go have a cup of coffee with me, or could I take you to dinner, or could I have your phone number, to would you go back right now and have sex with me in my room? And he did the same thing with a woman, an attractive woman standing in the middle of campus. And his data showed that women were I think never agreed to go back to the man's room and have sex right then, and sometimes agreed to some of the other choices, whereas men were more likely to agree to going back and having sex than to something like going on a date. And he thought that this really confirmed this kind of universal difference between the sexes. And, you know, of course, what he was really measuring is differences in the cost to men and women, the cultural costs of being seen to be sexual and perhaps promiscuous, even though that's a word we try not to use anymore because it just means you're having more sex than whoever's using the word thinks that you should have. It's not very empirical. But, I mean, really, you know, if you could have said to that woman, you know, will you come back and have sex with me right now and nothing bad will happen to you, you won't be hurt, nobody will find out, your reputation will not be ruined, you won't be sanctioned, etc., you probably get more women saying yes. So what he was really measuring were culturally induced differences, not biological differences. And I don't mean to just single him out. I could go on all day about the evolutionary psychologist. This is another one from he's now at MIT, or no, now he's at Harvard. He was at MIT, Steven Pinker, who has written a dozen books or so, where he seems to accept that men are more sexual than women, and there's a good biological explanation for that. A prehistoric man like Fred Flintstone here, if he sleeps with 50 women, he could have 50 babies, whereas there's absolutely no advantage to poor Wilma over here to sleeping with 50 men. She would have just as many kids as if she slept with one. Nobody bothered to test that, to see is there any advantage to having multiple sires of your young, to looking for genetic diversity in your offspring, to maybe getting more investment in your young by having multiple potential fathers for the sons. It was just kind of, you know, just accepted at face value. And it's come to be known as the copulatory imperative, this idea that men are just sort of half men, half beasts, they're driven by their genes, there's nothing they can do about it. And of course, that's led to a lot of hostility from feminist scholars and others in the general population who think this is really a bad practice to essentialize male and female differences, to suggest that something is natural and therefore okay, or natural and therefore inescapable. And plus, it's just actually not true to boot. And then, you know, in the broader social science community, I've encountered so much hostility to thinking that evolution could have anything to do with human behavior. This book, Against Love, which is written by Laura Kipnis, is a polemical kind of treatise on why monogamous marriage is bad. And you don't have to get very far into the book before she brings up the bonobo. And I don't have on my glasses, but I think it's about the third line, or it starts on the second line. Despite all of those enlightening studies of sexual behavior in the bonobos and the red-winged blackbirds, claiming to offer important insights into the nuances of human coupling, hearkening back to some remote evolutionary past for social explanations, does seem to be a smokescreen for other agendas. And that's the deeply held suspicion that somehow if you're using evolutionary biology, you're actually using it as a tool to promote some kind of social agenda. I use this book in a class that I teach called Love, Marriage, and the Experience of Being a Wife, which is how an evolutionary biologist looks at dynamics between the sexes. And I think the students think, oh, well, then, you know, should we be talking about bonobos in this class? And so it's really great because the next week we read Amanda Foreman's book, The Duchess, which is about the Duchess of Devonshire, who was part of the Whig Party when it was formed. And there were these fantastic dinner parties where nobody wanted to leave the room. They went on all night, and you didn't want to miss anything that could be really important. And so they established chamber pots in all four corners of the room so that you wouldn't have to leave. So if you go back to that that Kipnis quote for a minute, you'll see that, you know, she's only going to accept that bonobos are relevant when you have dinner party guests who shit in the corner of the garden during the middle of the dinner party. So that, well, okay, well, we've solved that problem because here you have evidence of a dinner party where that kind of thing is happening. And I do think that actually there's a lot of relevance to looking at other animals in terms of how we can understand our own circumstance. It doesn't mean we can't change our circumstances, but understanding the environmental and ecological variables that underlie the emergence of different behaviors can actually help us if we do want to make social changes. So I'm part of a group of women who feel similarly about that. This is Sarah Hurdy up on the left and Patty Gawadi on the right there. Patty Gawadi is an ornithologist who in one documentary was described as having blown the lid off of avian monogamy. So she's definitely somebody that you should all know. She's just a fantastic person. And these women were getting together and saying, wow, you know, we feel like we're getting hit on all sides here. We're feminists. We believe in equality between men and women. We particularly want to address that in the sciences, but we're not getting any support because our feminist sisters are deeply suspicious of how science has been used in the past, and justifiably so, but we don't seem to be able to get across a message that there are other ways to do the science. And so a group of us got together. I was really honored to be part of it. I was just a grad student with all of these amazing more senior female scientists at the time, to talk about how to do that. And we formed a group called the Darwinian Feminists out of that. And Sarah was really at the forefront of that group. She had written a book in the 80s called The Woman That Never Evolved. And really what she meant by that was there are no women like, or females in general, like Darwin described, that are coy and passive and uninterested in their sexual agendas. And that's why she called the book The Woman That Never Evolved. And she, I just lost my train of thought. Let me just think about that for a second. So she wrote this book, The Woman That Never Evolved, which really cataloged all of the different species where females have a lot of sexual agency, are choosing to have sex with lots of partners, etc. One of the evolutionary psychologists who reviewed the book, Don Simons, who wrote a very famous book on human sexuality, who was at one of the University of California schools, titled his book review, Another Woman That Never Existed. Right? So there was this deeply held belief among the male evolutionary psychologists that there are no females out there, that this is just agenda-driven, this is politically driven, this is because of your feminist politics or something like that. And I really think they've been proven wrong, but I mean, this stuff is really still not being taught in an updated way, at least in America now in 2013, even though everybody should really know about it by now. It emerged in the 1990s, which took long enough on its own. I want to talk a little bit about the cover of this most recent edition of The Woman That Never Evolved. I think Sarah must have had this painting commissioned. I keep meaning to ask her because I can't imagine. It's really sophisticated in terms of what it's conveying. So you see the men down below who are, you know, half proper gentlemen in their tuxes and half driven by their lower halves, which is kind of bestial, right? And they're pursuing these females who are like light little butterflies or birds who are endeavoring to for a long time to escape. And so that's very much the sort of male-male competition aspect of sexual selection theory. The painting continues on the back of the book, and you can see the male who is appealing to female choice. So he's playing the flute in order to show off, you know, his, it doesn't just have to be a flashy color. It can be that you sing a beautiful song or you're a great artist or different things to try to appeal to females to be chosen. But Darwin left a lot of things out that we now realize are important parts of sexual selection theory. For instance, we all know females compete, right? Everybody who's been to high school knows that females compete in really significant ways. So those Hanuman langurs that I showed you in the first slide of Sarah, Herdy, they're the temple monkeys that you see in India that are sacred with the really long tails. Males hold harems of females, and females approach males to initiate sex by kind of backing up to them and presenting their hindquarters and then lifting their tail and shuddering their heads. And this is an invitation for sex. They do this on many, many more days than when they're ovulating. So they're not just doing it in order to get pregnant. They seem to actually maybe want to have sex. So Volker Sommer at University College London looked at this, and he discovered that the more females a male mated with on a given day, the less likely any of them were to conceive. So he hypothesized and has good data to support the idea that females are soliciting males on days when they aren't ovulating in order to deplete the male of sperm so that other females in the harem can't get pregnant. And of course, if they did, those infants would be competitors for their own infants. So there are lots and lots of stories of that kind of female-female competition. So in addition to male-male competition and female choice, we have to acknowledge that there's also female-female competition. He also never imagined that males might be choosy, right? They're just supposed to be completely indiscriminate in who they mate with. And that's really interesting as well. And in chimpanzees, we're used to thinking about the world in these kind of ev-psych terms that males are want the youngest, most fertile, most virginal female because then you have the best chance of monopolizing her entire reproductive career. In chimps, young and experienced females actually have trouble getting males to mate with them. Males vastly prefer to mate with experienced mothers. And they will prefer a 55-year-old female to a 12-year-old female when they're being solicited by both of them. So it's not just that males are indiscriminate and take every mating opportunity that comes along. And even in our own species, you see a lot of traits that evolved in females, presumably to attract the opposite sex, certain waist-to-hip ratios, maybe the evolution of permanent breasts rather than just when you're lactating. Why would you need those if males are just always willing to mate with you no matter what? So these are really interesting things to think about. So in fact, there are at least four components to sexual selection theory. And in fact, there's another one that I think is the most important of all, and that is male-female competition. And Darwin didn't talk about that at all, other than to mention that males keep females in this abject state of bondage. But okay, so if they're doing that, you have to imagine that females are evolving counter strategies. And that's really interesting. Males and females may have interests that are on divergent paths or might be directly contrary to each other. And that might be driving a lot of evolution forward. And this really didn't start emerging until the 1990s. And as I say, it still hasn't been picked up by, I would say, kind of the mainstream evolutionary biologists teaching masses of undergrads in the American system. And it's really a pity. I don't think it's really taught routinely in London either. I'd be interested to know here in Australia how it's going, because it's all there in the literature if you want to pay attention to it. I think that it's important to recognize that there are these five components. It might make our feminist sisters in other disciplines more comfortable to realize that we're not really in bed with the evolutionary psych people. Evolutionary biologists are taking a truly evolutionary approach. We're looking at critical resources that females need to reproduce. We're looking at how those are acquired and controlled by males. We're asking a lot of the same questions. Who has power? How do you get it? What is it good for? What are the counter strategies? We could be working together on a lot of similar issues and maybe making more progress. So I would say that we need to realize that a female's choice of mates is influenced by environmental, social, physiological, and what we call phylogenetic constraints, meaning kind of the history of you know, what you evolved from and your kind of evolutionary lineage. So nothing is set in stone, certainly not gender roles. Females can be sexual, they can be competitive, they can be aggressive, they have their own agency, they have their own agendas. Sometimes those are in concert with males, sometimes they're not. And I think we would get a lot further if we took that approach rather than just simply essentializing males and females. I want to wrap up so we can go to our discussion, but I did want to mention we actually have data on a lot of this. So we know that in many, many species, females are mating with lots and lots of males. I mentioned Meredith Small and her work on macaques. These big genital swellings that you see in the top right there of the chimpanzee female are designed to show males that she's fertile, and that way they all come to her and she can mate with them rather than having to individually go and solicit lots of males. And a chimp female makes sure she mates with every male in the group multiple times every cycle, and that helps prevent infanticide of her infant because every male has a chance of having sired that infant. Jane Goodall wrote about this in her book In the Shadow of Man. She has a whole chapter devoted to a female named Flo, and in particular to her sex life. It's called Flo's Sex Life. And in it, she describes a scene that she, the way that she characterizes it is all these males line up to mate with Flo, and then one by one, each of the males mates with Flo. And I've always wondered, why did she characterize it like that, rather than saying Flo mated with each and every one of these males? So it can be very unconscious how we attribute the proactive actions to males and kind of the just receptive actions to females. And I think we need to be aware of that. There are plenty of human groups where, I mean, monogamy as a, just even a formal social system is by far the minority pattern in the world. And then when you look at how females actually behave, there's all kinds of variation. Some women in tribes in Tibet and Nepal hold harems of males, so it's a polyandrous society. In the Maasai and other groups of pastoralists in Africa, it's okay for females to have sex with anyone in their husband's circumcision cohort, because you don't want males fighting with each other over females within the group. They have plenty to do fighting males in other groups, so you don't want to jeopardize that solidarity amongst males. So there are a couple of options. Either you can kind of enforce strict monogamy, one male, one female, so that there aren't males who are left out, or you can just say, well, as long as he was my brother in the circumcision cohort, it's okay. That would be another way. This female down at the bottom is from a group called the Canela, which is in South America. They're a group that has a really interesting conception belief. They believe that babies are built up through multiple applications of semen so that babies can biologically have more than one father. And in fact, children who do have more than one father in the group are more likely to live to the age of 15 than children who only have one father. Because, you know, one might die, you have more investment when you have two fathers. So my personal belief is that this conception story probably originated with women. I think it's just a fantastic idea. The TD monkey there, which some of you might know, is held up as one of the most monogamous of monkeys. The male and the female sit together on the branch with their tails intertwined. And I mean, they're just the picture of domestic bliss. And they are really attached to their male partners. If you take a female's baby away from her and you measure her cortisol level, of course it goes way up. If you take the male away from her and measure that cortisol level, it goes much higher. So she's definitely very bonded to this male. Nonetheless, in the wild, when some random stranger male comes through, she takes every opportunity that she has to mate with them. So, I mean, there's just a lot of reasons why it might be good to have, you know, genetic diversity for your offspring, to have investment from several males, and of course, just maybe to enjoy, in the species that seem to enjoy sex, having multiple partners. So I think we could maybe open it up with and move to the dialogue here, and then to the audience. But maybe all of you could start giving some thought to the question of why it took so long to come to the idea that the interests of the two sexes might be in opposition to each other. I think on a popular level, it's intuitive. We have books like Men Are from Mars and Women Are from Venus and he's just not that into you. And then somebody wrote a book back, well, be honest, you're not that into him either, which I thought was fantastic. So I think there's this sort of, you know, popular recognition that, that the interests of the sexes might be in opposition, but it's taken a long, long time in academia and in the sciences. So I want to thank you for your attention. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about Darwinian feminism.
We have a lot more to talk about, don't we? You've been kind of creating the context in which your bonobo work should be considered, basically, haven't you? So, I mean, and why it is significant for humans, why it is actually really relevant, which is what's so fascinating. Tell us a bit about actually, in the 20-plus years that you've been working on, describe that society. You've used the word matriarchal, which is a very, I would have thought, human concept, maybe not. So tell us about the bonobos themselves.
So bonobos are really fascinating in that unrelated females get together with each other. They have a lot of same-sex sexual interactions. They're called GG rubbing, genital-genital rubbing. And that seems to help them to have solidarity and bond with each other so that they form these coalitions and cooperatively attack males, control food sources. There's no sexual coercion in bonobos, unlike the rampant sexual coercion you see in chimps. Females are free to mate with any male they want. So even though they're the ones with the kind of make love, not war, sexy kind of orgy-like reputation, in fact, they probably are a little bit more restricted than chimps. I mean, they certainly don't feel compelled to mate with every male in the group every cycle. They can pick and choose, and they pick a broad variety, but they certainly seem to have a lot of agency. They can mate with males in other groups in front of their own community males, which would never in a million years happen in chimps without getting killed. So it was interesting when I just made these discoveries, because the male chimp researchers had the corner on the market of what man's closest living relative had been doing for about 50 years, and they'd built all these models of hominid evolution based on that patriarchal system, male bonding, male coercion, hunting, chimps kill each other in these warfare parties, and all of that seemed to, again, validate our own behavior and make it seem really set in stone if it goes back 5 million years. So they weren't that eager to hear about this other closest living relative with this radically different pattern. So my favorite response was a researcher who said, oh, no, no, it's not female dominance, it's strategic male deference. So, of course, the males could have the power if they wanted to, but for strategic reasons, they're just stepping back and letting it seem that the females are in charge. Nobody has ever, ever suggested that when the pattern has been described as a male-dominated society. Nobody's ever suggested females could have the power but are just stepping back. So I think, you know, we just have to be fair in terms of what the baseline is. So I think that's probably an overview.
And what about the evidence that you said, I think Franz Wall had collected, though had actually omitted to examine properly, that 24 of the 25 attacks were by females on males? Is that broad scale? What does that mean?
Yeah, so I work with the world's captive population of bonobos. There are only 200 in the world in zoos, and then they only live in the former Zaire in a really war-torn area that's pretty dangerous to work in. So I was going from zoo to zoo and seeing these really horrific attacks that females would seem to launch. It didn't seem provoked by anything. It's really hard to say. But, you know, they were biting off fingers. They bit a male's penis in half in Stuttgart. Every zoo thought it was something wrong with their particular male. So they had all these kind of folkloric stories to explain something that was so shocking and puzzling to them, because it seemed to defy the natural order of things. So they would say, oh, this male was sick when he was young, and a female keeper took him home, and she must have coddled him, and now he's soft. And but because I was going from zoo to zoo, I kept seeing this pattern. So I started looking at the veterinary records, because these injuries have to be treated. And so I could compile a really strong case that anytime you have multiple females together, this is one of the things they do. The zoo's response was really interesting. They felt so sorry for these males. And, I mean, I do too. But they started, you know, separating the males at night, letting them have their own kind of quarters and stuff to keep them away from the females, which I think actually
only exacerbated the tension, because he could be kind of obnoxious from the safety of his night cage, and then in the day he was still let out with them, and you know, then they would have a chance to address that. So I don't think they were helping him. And also, nobody's ever done that when chimp males are injuring females. That's just the way chimps are, and that's nature, and that's, you know, what we have to accept. So I found the kind of human response really interesting, that there was such a sense of this compelling need to intervene that wasn't there for other species where it's just accepted, because it just seems so unnatural.
I mean, you're telling us as it's amusing, and I mean, it's really fascinating. But at some level, it's actually, I find this really disturbing. It's one thing for Darwin, who of course was writing, as you say, from 150 years ago, and maybe that was true because of what had been done to Victorian women. Franz Weil, at least he assembled the information, even if he didn't interpret it properly or fully. But what you're talking about actually is a degree of, I mean, I'm not suggesting it's a scientific conspiracy or anything, but you're talking about actually a degree of willful blindness to what our scientific, important scientific research has carried on over decades, published and so on. What do we do about that?
Well, I can think of lots of other examples of that. I mean, think about climate change, at least in the United States. I mean, our media insists that there are two sides to that story, and there are not two sides. It's definitely happening, and it's definitely caused by humans. And if you look at the science, you know, there might be, at best, maybe one scientist out of every 100 who would say that this is not a certain kind of conclusion at this point. And yet, so it happens in a lot of disciplines. Fracking, you know, we've got actually a lot of academics who are complicit in kind of muddying the water, so to speak, on whether fracking is really dangerous and how poisonous it is to our land, because they're getting paid by the fracking industry to do the studies. And so we need strong, independent science, but we also need a diversity of scientists. And so when all the science is done by men, you get sort of one, you know, white kind of privileged men, you get one kind of perspective. And I think when you open it up, science, the great thing about science is not that it's unbiased. It's certainly, we can find lots of examples of bias in science, but it's self-correcting through time. So, you know, somebody comes along and tries to repeat your study and they can't, and then, you know, you have a number of opportunities to clarify. And so I do think, you know, the arc of justice, in a way, applies to science as well.
We'll go to questions shortly, but one second, I'd just like to ask, are there other species, okay, that you haven't studied intensively the same way that you have bonobos, but are there other species you could point to which have this kind of matriarchal, with all its positive and, I suppose, for the male bonobos, very negative consequences?
So there are a number of species that are arranged along lines of female power. Even elephants, of course, are very matriarchal, and males are sort of peripheral to the group. It's a little less surprising. I'm not discounting it, but it's not as surprising when related females get together and have their power through their kinship. It's more rare when they're doing it through these coalitions of unrelated females. A species that I just absolutely love is a species of bird called the Panamanian jacana, where it's a species that's a water bird, and they lay their eggs on the water, on leaves, and crocodiles eat them. And so it's really hard to stay in front of that and not get wiped out by the crocodile predation. If a female has to not only lay the eggs but sit on them, it really lengthens generation time. If instead she can mate with a male, lay the eggs, and have him sit on them, she can move on to the next male and lay another clutch. So females have harems of males that are producing multiple clutches for her, and she competes with other females over access to males. She goes around and breaks open the eggs of other females so that that male is freed up to sit on her eggs. She's bigger than the male, so there's all this kind of female fighting, female infanticide. So it's a just spectacular textbook example of how gender roles are not set in stone. It really depends on the ecological variables, you know, how everybody behaves.
Now, who would I'm just going to ask, because it's a really great subject, and it is prone. I can see you. It's prone to strong views, so you can ask the toughest questions you want to. What I would ask, though, is that we only have about 15 minutes. So if you would make sure that we, you know, this is not a time for statements. This is actually a question and an opportunity to hear Amy Parish's response to whatever question you want to ask. Okay?
Yeah, I'm an ethical publisher and journalist, and I do my work online. I'm a non-profit organisation. I tell the truth, and I'm called a whistleblower by chance. I've looked at all this stuff. I've met both of you online. I've phoned you up, Jennifer, lots of times. I've phoned you and sent emails because you deal with lots of stuff.
I think we could we have a question,
yeah.
Sir?
Yeah, anyway, the question is, there's been a survey that was done in the States, and it was to look at the sexuality of male and female. And the left was male, the right was female, the centre was either. They did the census, thousands and thousands of people over many years, and they come up with statistics. Most people there weren't that many were left or right, there weren't that many centre. Most of them were shades of grey, which actually was very interesting because this has a very profound significance for the American Constitution.
Do you want to cite the study, who actually did it and where?
Well, I put it online.
I
found out it through a TED Talk. TED Talk's online, but okay. I can't remember actually quote it, but it's on my website. I've got the links here.
Okay.
So I think that's a great theme, that things are most of the time not black or white. There's a whole continuum of response, and whether it's kind of political affiliation or sexual orientation, I mean, how do you decide if somebody's gay or straight? Those aren't binary things. I mean, you have to ask, what do you fantasize about? What opportunities have you had to act on those fantasies? And when you do that, it turns out most people are not sort of a 0 or a 7 on the Kinsey scale. They're somewhere in between. And perhaps the truest measure of your orientation is what do you fantasize about? Because then you don't have those cultural constraints in the way. I would say in terms of science, a really classic critique of that black and white approach was Carol Gilligan, who's at Harvard, who wrote a book called In a Different Voice. And when she was a psych grad student, her professor had looked at ethical decisions of men and women. So if you ask a question like, your spouse is dying and you can't afford the medicine, do you steal it? Men would either say yes or no, it's okay or it's not. And women would say, oh, you know, maybe I could barter, maybe I could pay over time, maybe I could get my kin together. And Carol Gilligan's professor had interpreted the female response as a childlike response, that they didn't have the maturity to come to a firm conclusion, right? So she did her own studies and actually interpreted it in a different way, that's actually a much more sophisticated way of looking at the world, to look at all these shades of gray. And so I do think it's a fantastic point that, yeah, there are, and it's something that we need to do a better job of in science. And I realize today I really have focused on heterosexual relationships, and that's not because I think that other relationships aren't equally important. It was just for the purposes of talking about kind of the origins of this Darwinian feminism movement.
Your focus of your work seems to be about sexual behaviour, and that's one of the behaviours that we and all other species engage in. But there's also, and I think that in human terms, there's very big competition between men and women about economic resources and food, and that's very basic, and every being has to have some. So is there research being done on the competition and sexual, you know, behaviour around who gets resources?
That's such a fantastic question. Yes, I think in evolutionary biology, the idea is that females can only have a limited number of offspring in their lifetimes, and so they want to maximize the quality of each of those. And to do that, you need resources. And so females are posited to really care a lot about resources. And yet, the way the patriarchy is set up, it's very hard for females to get resources on their own. So you have to go through men to get them. It's a huge topic in this love, marriage, experience of being a wife class that I teach. I have a divorce lawyer come. I have couples counselors come. The couples counselors say the two issues couples fight the most about are children and money. The divorce lawyer says, you know, she's a really high power Orange County divorce attorney. She says, if you don't have your own money, you know, really watch out when you have to get a divorce because you're just going to be completely disempowered. If you look actually at divorces for both men and women, socioeconomic status falls after the divorce. But within a couple years, for men, it begins to rise again, and then it exceeds what it was in the marriage. For women, they never recover on average. It's just economically devastating for women because men control the resources. So this is a really, really crucial point. And the one takeaway message I ask my students to take from the course is make your own money. I mean, it's just absolutely, and you can go back to, I mean, it was a theme in A Doll's House, right, by Ibsen. I mean, here's this woman who needs to save her, you know, Nora needs to save Torvald's life. She has to forge his, her father's name on a bank document because women aren't allowed to, you know, to take out money in their own name. And is he grateful when he finds out? No, he's all upset that she, you know, sullied his reputation. And then she really realizes how much a piece of property she's been to him. So yeah, I think it's so glad you brought that up because it's, you just cannot emphasize enough the importance of having your own economic power. So the follow-up question was, is that studied in animals? Yes, there's a lot of study of how resources are controlled. So in certain species, males don't control females directly, but they just monopolize something females need, like the only place to lay your eggs or the only place to the only beach to nurse your pups. And therefore, then they have a lot of control over the females. So it can be direct physical control. It can be control of a resource that females need. You know, in the hanging fly, males will release a pheromone when they've caught another insect, and females will come and inspect what the male has to offer. And if they like it, they let the male copulate with them while they eat the prey item. Well, they have this big elastic sac called the spermatheca that can hold lots of ejaculate, but you know, eventually it does get full. If it gets full while she's still eating, the male snatches back the rest of the prey item so he can offer it to another female. Similarly, if a female finishes the prey item and the male's not done copulating, she also breaks it off. So it's very economic, and there's lots of those kinds of sex for food kind of exchanges in the animal kingdom.
So just going to that... that you say to young women about making sure that they've got their own money. An extension of that then is to make sure that women get into positions to also affect the laws of the land as well, because, you know, with the what you're saying there in America, and I know it happens elsewhere, but so if a woman is in a situation where she goes through a divorce and then ends up, you know, with the bad thing, surely if more women get into... situations of where they're starting to make that power, that should become... I'm not saying for a minute that women shouldn't have their own independence, because I think they should, but also that we need to look at fairer laws for women as well.
I totally agree. You know, the very popular book at the moment in America is called Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, who's the CEO of Facebook. And, you know, her argument is that, well, yes, there's discrimination against women, but also... It's sort of this idea, I'm paraphrasing, that women are their own worst enemies, and they're not ambitious enough, and they don't take a job because they know eventually they want to have kids when they don't even have a boyfriend yet, and so women need to lean in. And I just think, where's the part of the equation that business needs to lean in and quit discriminating against women? Pay them equal pay for equal work, et cetera, right? So I don't know why the onus is on each individual woman to overcome the system rather than affecting the system, which just reminds me, I feel a little bad. I didn't mean to imply that Franz de Waal is one of these patriarchal males, because he actually, when he saw my data, he just immediately acknowledged and said, oh, isn't that fascinating? So he and I are really on the same page about female power and bonobos. So I just want to say he's one of the good guys. But I totally get what you're saying about, you know, how we need to look at institutions. And I love what they're doing in Scandinavia, mandating that, you know, boards of businesses have to be half women, parliaments, et cetera. I mean, we need to do some things at a larger level than the poor individual female is to take on the whole system.
I know there's another question behind, so if you'd like to pass back, but just before we do that, if I can, it's like a follow-up to your question, which is, we're talking about economic expectations and the need to have a degree of economic independence, which enables freedom and independence. But the examples I was using, you know, between the Iranian Revolution, which was, I think, 1978, wasn't it? So 35 years ago. And the Egyptian Revolution, which was last year, what completely struck me, and this is not
actually, I don't think particularly a comment about Islam. I think it's just about, it's not changed. After 35 years of what we in the West, I think, you know, nothing's perfect, but I think we would all say we have, you know, this is a great time for women, for Western women, by and large, compared to where we've come from. You've moved from particulars of bonobos and you're drawing interpretations for humans. Can we go the other way, which is that what is it about humans that we wage this endless war and we behave the same way? It's always the women who are sent back.
Well, there definitely is that perception, which I think makes it easier for people to fall into being enraptured with the ev-psych people, because it does seem so universal. But there's this wonderful scholar, Alice Eagly, who looked at the work of people like David Buss. Another one of his studies had gone supposedly from all kinds of different cultures to sample and found that, you know, in every culture, men want young, fertile women and women want older, rich men. But all of those societies were governed by patriarchy. So if you looked at societies where women had opportunities to get resources in ways other than going through men, then they start to want different things. So there are societies where women are more economically independent, and then maybe they want the young, fertile guy. You know, I mean, it's just, or, you know, the soulmate. I mean, really, if you actually look at the data, both men and women, the top four things they want in a mate are exactly the same: nice, sense of humor, reliable, et cetera. It's only beyond that, and we really focus on these differences, which is kind of silly. But so I think, you know, it's just, there is more variation out there. And it's a pity that in all of these revolutions, it seems to fall back right into the same pattern of women are part of the overthrow, but then, you know, don't get to really reap the benefits of that. And often it feels like two steps forward, one step back. But I do feel, I mean, we are making progress. For me, the glass is still kind of half empty, but I have hope that we're going to make more progress than that in the future.
I'm just wondering the role of the affective domain in your research. I've done a little bit of feminist study, and it seems that that sort of that interior affective aspect of the individual is not always looked at. And I was just wondering, like with your work with the bonobo, for example, is it different that they're in captivity compared to in
What I can say about that is the repertoire of behavior that we see in zoos is the same repertoire that we see in the wild. So there's nothing they do in a zoo that they don't also do in the wild, or vice versa. But rates can be different, because in the wild, you know, you're kind of pampered in a way in a good zoo, because somebody's making your food and cleaning your cage, and it's not, you don't have to go through the forest you know, worrying about predators and those kinds of things. So they have more time on their hands. So rates of sexual behavior are higher in captivity than in the wild, although there's still a lot of sexual behavior going on in the wild as well. But the overall repertoire seems to be the same. And it's interesting, because in Stuttgart, I've studied chimps and bonobos side by side. So they have identical enclosures. It's almost a quasi-experimental setting. I mean, they have the same keepers, the same food, the same temperature, basic same group composition, and yet the chimps still act like chimps in the wild, and the bonobos still act like bonobos in the wild. So, you know, some of the chimp researchers criticized both me and Franz early on that our data came from captivity. But I just think that was an easy way out, because everything that we know so far from the wild confirms the kind of more detailed kind of data that we were able to get from the zoos.
We're going to have to leave it there, because, as you know, we've hit the 11:30, the 12:30 mark, and I know that a number of you have other sessions you want to attend. But just to take you out, while we were waiting for everyone to arrive, I said to Amy, "What has been her, you know, her greatest peak sort of wildlife experience when she has felt really close, and that in fact it really is only a couple of percentage points that divides the genes?" And this is what she told me.
I think we first talked about an experience I had holding an infant gorilla who pressed its forehead to mine, and we looked into each other's eyes, and it was this really electric moment. I mean, my hair just stood on end. I really felt like we were connecting across 8 million years of evolution and having this just incredibly intimate interspecies moment. The second anecdote I told was after I'd had my son and I brought him back to the bonobos in San Diego for the first time. He was about 6 months old and he was on my hip. And one of the females was super excited to see me and really, you know, looking at my son and looking at me and vocalizing. And then she went away and got her new baby and brought him back and held him up by his arms in front of me. And we had kind of this maternal exchange of, oh, we've both had babies. And the third thing was the zoo was having trouble with one of their females. They were saying that she didn't want to nurse her baby. And I thought, well, let's see what happens if I go down and nurse in front of them. So I took my son down, and nobody does that in San Diego. I don't know about Australia, but nobody nurses in front of the bonobo enclosure. I came right up to the glass, and I started nursing him, and every bonobo in that group came running over. They were standing on top of each other to look from every angle, and it seemed really clear that they were stunned that we did that because they've never seen humans do that. So I think, you know, there's not actually... very little bonobos know about us. All they see are keepers kind of preparing their food and cleaning their cages and then people standing in front of the glass looking at them. And it would be really fascinating to, you know, kind of do a humans 101 for them, which is a project I'm working on for the spring, so they can actually see a much wider range of human behavior, because I think they'd probably be fascinated, and that was kind of a more egalitarian exchange of information. So thank you for being here, and thank you for moderating.
Thank you very much. In fact, you wonder if the bonobos go home and they'll tell stories of, you know, these humans, they kind of slouch around. All they ever do is lift up things. They hardly talk. It's very dull. Poor things. Won't you please say a big warm thank you to Dr. Amy Parrish.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.